Science and Happiness. The purpose of the moralist is to improve men's behaviour. This is a laudable ambition, since their behaviour is for the most part deplorable. But I cannot praise the moralist either for the particular improvements he desires or for the methods he adopts for achieving them. His ostensible method is moral exhortation. His real method, if he is orthodox, is a system of economic rewards and punishments. The former effects nothing permanent or important. The influence of revivalists from Savonarola downward has always been very transitory. The latter, the rewards and punishments, have a very considerable effect. They cause a man, for example, to prefer casual prostitutes to a quasi-permanent mistress, because it is necessary to adopt the method which is most easily concealed. They thus keep up the numbers of a very dangerous profession, and secure the prevalence of venereal disease. These are not the objects desired by the moralist, and he is too unscientific to notice that they are the objects which he actually achieves. Is there anything better to be substituted for this unscientific mixture of preaching and bribery? I think there is. Men's actions are harmful either from ignorance or from bad desires. Bad desires, when we are speaking from a social point of view, may be defined as those which tend to thwart the desires of others, or, more exactly, those which thwart more desires than they assist. It is not necessary to dwell upon the harmfulness that springs from ignorance. Here, more knowledge is all that is wanted, so that the road to improvement lies in more research and more education, but the harmfulness that springs from bad desires is a more difficult matter. In the ordinary man and woman there is a certain amount of active malevolence, both special ill-will directed to particular enemies and general impersonal pleasure in the misfortunes of others. It is customary to cover this over with fine phrases. About half of conventional morality is a cloak for it. But it must be faced if the moralist's aim of improving our actions is to be achieved. It is shown in a thousand ways, great and small. In the glee with which people repeat and believe scandal. In the unkind treatment of criminals, in spite of clear proof that better treatment would have more effect in reforming them. In the unbelievable barbarity with which all white races treat Negroes. And in the gusto with which old ladies and clergymen pointed out the duty of military service to young men during the war. Even children may be the objects of wanton cruelty. David Copperfield and Oliver Twist are by no means imaginary. This active malevolence is the worst feature of human nature, and the one which it is most necessary to change if the world is to grow happier. Probably this one cause has more to do with war than all the economic and political causes put together. Given this problem of preventing malevolence, how shall we deal with it? First, let us try to understand its causes. These are, I think, partly social, partly physiological. The world, now as much as at any former time, is based upon life and death competition. The question at issue in the war was whether German or Allied children should die of want and starvation. Apart from malevolence on both sides, there was not the slightest reason why both should not survive. Most people have in the background of their minds a haunting fear of ruin. This is especially true of people who have children. The rich fear that Bolsheviks will confiscate their investments. The poor fear that they will lose their job or their health. Everyone is engaged in the frantic pursuit of security and imagines that this is to be achieved by keeping potential enemies in subjection. It is in moments of panic that cruelty becomes most widespread and most atrocious. Reactionaries everywhere appeal to fear. In England, to fear of Bolshevism. In France, to fear of Germany. In Germany, to fear of France. And the sole effect of their appeals is to increase the danger against which they wish to be protected. It must therefore be one of the chief concerns of the scientific moralist to combat fear. This can be done in two ways, by increasing security and by cultivating courage. I am speaking of fear as an irrational passion, not of the rational prevision of possible misfortune. When a theatre catches fire, The rational man foresees disaster just as clearly as the man stricken with panic, but he adopts methods likely to diminish the disaster, whereas the man stricken with panic increases it. Europe since 1914 has been like a panic-stricken audience in a theatre on fire. What is needed is calm, authoritative directions as to how to escape without trampling each other to pieces in the process. The Victorian age, for all its humbug, was a period of rapid progress because men were dominated by hope rather than fear. If we are again to have progress, we must again be dominated by hope. Everything that increases the general security is likely to diminish cruelty. This applies to prevention of war, whether through the instrumentality of the League of Nations or otherwise, to prevention of destitution, to better health by improvement in medicine, hygiene, and sanitation, and to all other methods of lessening the terrors that lurk in the abysses of men's minds and emerge as nightmares when they sleep. But nothing is accomplished by an attempt to make a portion of mankind secure at the expense of another portion. Frenchmen at the expense of Germans, capitalists at the expense of wage earners, white men at the expense of yellow men, and so on. Such methods only increase terror in the dominant group, lest just resentment should lead the oppressed to rebel. Only justice can give security, and by justice I mean the recognition of the equal claims of all human beings. In addition to social changes designed to bring security, there is, however, another and more direct means of diminishing fear, namely by a regimen designed to increase courage. Owing to the importance of courage in battle, men early discovered means of increasing it by education and diet. Eating human flesh, for example, was supposed to be useful. But military courage was to be the prerogative of the ruling caste. Spartans were to have more than helots, British officers more than Indian privates, men more than women, and so on. For centuries it was supposed to be the privilege of the aristocracy. Every increase of courage in the ruling caste was used to increase the burdens on the oppressed, and therefore to increase the grounds for fear in the oppressors, and therefore to leave the causes of cruelty undiminished. Courage must be democratized before it can make men humane. To a great extent, courage has already been democratized by recent events. The suffragettes showed that they possessed as much courage as the bravest men. This demonstration was essential in winning them the vote. The common soldier in the war needed as much courage as a captain or lieutenant, and much more than a general. This had much to do with his lack of servility after demobilization. The Bolsheviks, who proclaim themselves the champions of the proletariat, are not lacking in courage, whatever else may be said of them. This is proved by their pre-revolutionary record. In Japan, where formerly the samurai had a monopoly of martial ardour, conscription brought the need of courage throughout the male population. Thus, among all the great powers, much has been done during the past half century to make courage no longer an aristocratic monopoly. If this were not the case, the danger to democracy would be far greater than it is. But courage in fighting is by no means the only form, nor perhaps even the most important. There is courage in facing poverty, courage in facing derision, courage in facing the hostility of one's own herd. In these, the bravest soldiers are often lamentably deficient. And above all, there is the courage to think calmly and rationally in the face of danger, and to control the impulse of panic fear or panic rage. These are certainly things which education can help to give, and the teaching of every form of courage is rendered easier by good health, good physique, adequate nourishment, and free play for fundamental vital impulses. Perhaps the physiological sources of courage could be discovered by comparing the blood of a cat with that of a rabbit. In all likelihood, there is no limit to what science could do in the way of increasing courage, by example, experience of danger, an athletic life, and a suitable diet. All these things our upper-class boys to a great extent enjoy, but as yet they are in the main the prerogative of wealth. The courage so far encouraged in the poorer sections of the community is courage under orders, not the kind that involves initiative and leadership. When the qualities that now confer leadership have become universal, there will no longer be leaders and followers, and democracy will have been realized at last. But fear is not the only source of malevolence. Envy and disappointment also have their share. The envy of cripples and hunchbacks is proverbial as a source of malignity, but other misfortunes than theirs produce similar results. A man or woman who has been thwarted sexually is apt to be full of envy. This generally takes the form of moral condemnation of the more fortunate. Much of the driving force of revolutionary movements is due to envy of the rich. Jealousy is, of course, a special form of envy. Envy of love. The old often envy the young. When they do, they are apt to treat them cruelly. There is, so far as I know, no way of dealing with envy except to make the lives of the envious happier and fuller, and to encourage in youth the idea of collective enterprises rather than competition. The worst forms of envy are in those who have not had a full life in the way of marriage or children or career. Such misfortunes could in most cases be avoided by better social institutions. Still, it must be admitted that a residuum of envy is likely to remain. There are many instances in history of generals so jealous of each other that they prefer defeat to enhancement of the other's reputation. Two politicians of the same party, or two artists of the same school, are almost sure to be jealous of each other. In such cases, there seems nothing to be done except to arrange, as far as possible, that each competitor shall be unable to injure the other, and shall only be able to win by superior merit. An artist's jealousy of a rival does little harm, usually, because the only effective way of indulging it is to paint better pictures than his rival's, since it is not open to him to destroy his rival's pictures. Where envy is unavoidable, it must be used as a stimulus to one's own efforts, not to the thwarting of the efforts of rivals. The possibilities of science in the way of increasing human happiness are not confined to diminishing those aspects of human nature which make for mutual defeat, and which we therefore call bad. There is probably no limit to what science can do in the way of increasing positive excellence. Health has already been greatly improved. In spite of the lamentations of those who idealize the past, we live longer and have fewer illnesses than any class or nation in the 18th century. With a little more application of the knowledge we already possess, we might be much healthier than we are, and future discoveries are likely to accelerate this process enormously. So far, it has been physical science that has had most effect upon our lives, but in the future, physiology and psychology are likely to be far more potent. When we have discovered how character depends upon physiological conditions, we shall be able, if we choose, to produce far more of the type of human beings that we admire. Intelligence, artistic capacity, benevolence, all these things no doubt could be increased by science. There seems scarcely any limit to what could be done in the way of producing a good world, if only men would use science wisely. I have expressed elsewhere my fears that men may not make a wise use of the power they derive from science. At present, I am concerned with the good that men could do if they chose, not with the question whether they will choose rather to do harm. There is a certain attitude about the application of science to human life with which I have some sympathy, though I do not in the last analysis agree with it. It is the attitude of those who dread what is unnatural. Rousseau is, of course, the great protagonist of this view in Europe. In Asia, Lao Tse has set it forth even more persuasively, and 2,400 years sooner. I think there is a mixture of truth and falsehood in the admiration of nature, which it is important to disentangle. To begin with, what is natural? Roughly speaking, anything to which the speaker was accustomed in childhood. Lao Tse objects to roads and carriages and boats, all of which were probably unknown in the village where he was born. Rousseau has got used to these things and does not regard them as against nature, but he would no doubt have thundered against railways if he had lived to see them. Clothes and cooking are too ancient to be denounced by most of the apostles of nature, though they all object to new fashions in either. Birth control is thought wicked by people who tolerate celibacy, because the former is a new violation of nature, and the latter an ancient one. In all these ways, those who preach nature are inconsistent, and one is tempted to regard them as mere conservatives. Nevertheless, there is something to be said in their favour. Take, for instance, vitamins, the discovery of which has produced a revulsion in favour of natural foods. It seems, however, that vitamins can be supplied by cod liver oil and electric light, which are certainly not part of the natural diet of a human being. This case illustrates that, in the absence of knowledge, unexpected harm may be done by a new departure from nature, but when the harm has come to be understood, it can usually be remedied by some new artificiality. As regards our physical environment and our physical means of gratifying our desires, I do not think the doctrine of nature justifies anything beyond a certain experimental caution in the adoption of new expedients. Clothes, for instance, are contrary to nature, and need to be supplemented by another unnatural practice, namely washing, if they are not to bring disease, but the two practices together make a man healthier than the savage who eschews both. There is more to be said for nature in the realm of human desires. To force upon man, woman, or child a life which thwarts their strongest impulses is both cruel and dangerous. In this sense, a life according to nature is to be commended with certain provisos. Nothing could be more artificial than an underground electric railway, but no violence is done to a child's nature when it is taken to travel in one. On the contrary, almost all children find the experience delightful. Artificialities which gratify the desires of ordinary human beings are good, other things being equal. But there is nothing to be said for ways of life which are artificial in the sense of being imposed by authority or economic necessity. Such ways of life are no doubt to some extent necessary at present. Ocean travel would become very difficult if there were no stokers on steamers. But necessities of this kind are regrettable, and we ought to look for ways of avoiding them. A certain amount of work is not a thing to complain of. Indeed, in 9 cases out of 10, it makes a man happier than complete idleness. But the amount and kind of work that most people have to do at present is a grave evil. Especially bad is the lifelong bondage to routine. Life should not be too closely regulated or too methodical. Our impulses, when not positively destructive or injurious to others, ought, if possible, to have free play. There should be room for adventure. Human nature we should respect, because our impulses and desires are the stuff out of which our happiness is to be made. It is no use to give men something abstractedly considered good. We must give them something desired or needed if we are to add to their happiness. Science may learn in time to mould our desires so that they shall not conflict with those of other people to the same extent as they do now. Then we shall be able to satisfy a larger proportion of our desires than at present. In that sense, but in that sense only, our desires will then have become better. A single desire is no better and no worse, considered in isolation, than any other. But a group of desires is better than another group if all of the first group can be satisfied simultaneously, while in the second group some are inconsistent with others. That is why love is better than hatred. To respect physical nature is foolish. Physical nature should be studied with a view to making it serve human ends as far as possible. But it remains ethically neither good nor bad. And where physical nature and human nature interact, as in the population question, there is no need to fold our hands in passive adoration and accept war, pestilence, and famine as the only possible means of dealing with excessive fertility. The divines say it is wicked in this matter to apply science to the physical side of the problem. We must, they say, apply morals to the human side and practice abstinence. Apart from the fact that everyone, including the divines, knows that their advice will not be taken, why should it be wicked to solve the population question by adopting physical means for preventing conception? No answer is forthcoming except one based upon antiquated dogmas, and clearly the violence to nature advocated by the divines is at least as great as that involved in birth control. The divines prefer a violence to human nature which, when successfully practiced, involves unhappiness, envy, a tendency to persecution, often madness. I prefer a violence to physical nature which is of the same sort as that involved in the steam engine, or even in the use of an umbrella. This instance shows how ambiguous and uncertain is the application of the principle that we should follow nature. Nature, even human nature, will cease more and more to be an absolute datum. More and more it will become what scientific manipulation has made it. Science can, if it chooses, enable our grandchildren to live the good life by giving them knowledge, self-control, and characters productive of harmony rather than strife. At present, it is teaching our children to kill each other, because many men of science are willing to sacrifice the future of mankind to their own momentary prosperity. But this phase will pass when men have acquired the same domination over their own passions that they already have over the physical forces of the external world. Then, at last, we shall have won our freedom.